Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday, June 17th, 2022 edition of On Iowa Politics. On the podcast this week, Grassley and Ernst on the gun bill, primary absentee voting, Deidre Dejir begins her general election campaign, and a big abortion ruling. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me today are Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Jared McNed of the Sioux City Journal. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning, Aaron. The phrase of the day is holy cannoli.
Holy cannoli. I loved that one. Fantastic. And Gazette opinion editor Todd Dorman. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
And making his triumphant return today to the podcast, please welcome back Tom Barton, formerly of the Quad City Times, which you remember him from before, and now the Gazette's Deputy Des Moines Bureau Chief. Welcome back to the podcast roster, Tom.
Thank you.
All right. First up this week, Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst weighed in on proposed framework to legislation designed to address mass shootings in public places, including school buildings. A bipartisan group of senators announced the framework on the deal last Sunday. And this week, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell indicated he will vote for the bill. That is, of course, assuming said bill makes it to the Senate floor for a vote. No guarantee on that at this early point. The proposal takes modest steps on gun control, making more juvenile records available when someone under 21 buys a rifle, closing the so-called boyfriend loophole by barring individuals convicted of domestic abuse from owning a gun. It also provides federal funding designed to entice states to enact so-called red flag laws, which allow loved ones or law enforcement to ask a court to prohibit an individual who they deem to be a danger to themselves or others from possessing guns. Senator Ernst, through her spokesman, only said that she will wait to see the bill before offering any thoughts on the proposal. Very limited response. Senator Grassley this week said his two benchmarks for being able to support the bill are that he said it should not violate anyone's constitutional rights to own a gun or to due process. Todd, let me ask you to gaze into your crystal ball, shake that magic eight ball, ask the Ouija board, whatever you have to do. Tell us whether either of Iowa's U.S. senators will cast a yes vote on this bill.
My hand on the Ouija board is being pushed around, and it says, oh, hell no. They won't.
I didn't know that was a spot on the Ouija board. That I don't remember that.
Well, it's on my Ouija board. It is.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of an adult Ouija board. Yeah, I would be surprised if they voted for it. I mean, they're talking about, you know, they want to see the details, which, you know, of course, creates a situation where once the details come out, they can say, oh, these details, there are all sorts of devils in them. And I don't want to, we can't support this. You know, the due process argument is one that's been deployed. It was deployed by Joni Ernst during the debate over the Violence Against Women's Act when they tried to close the boyfriend loophole, you know, and deny the right to buy a gun to people who have been convicted of you know, domestic abuse and dating situations. That was the argument that Ernst made why she didn't support that, was it didn't give proper due process. You know, it's easy to look at some of this stuff and say, well, this is infringing on a constitutional right if that's the way you want to interpret it. So I would be surprised if they voted for it. I mean, the other part of this is that Grassley's up for re-election. He just had a primary where a candidate running from his right got 26% of the vote. And he probably doesn't want to alienate, you know, the gun rights groups and others that support gun rights that are part of the Republican base in Iowa. So, I would be surprised if either of them ended up voting for the package. And in fact, it's one of those things where if enough Republicans aren't going to vote for it, I don't even know that it will come up for a vote because they might not want to have senators who are maybe in more vulnerable positions to have to take a bad vote against gun safety.
Yeah, you stole my follow-up question there, was if you think it'll even make it to the floor for a vote. I think that obviously remains a very open question as of right now. Legislation like this is, a deal, quote-unquote, can sound good in theory, especially before there's an actual legislative text. And like you said, once there is an actual bill, then that creates openings for anyone who might be on the fence or not wanting to support a bill to find something, you know, in their line 9 on paragraph 5 on page 33 that I have a problem with this, and that's why I can't support the bill. That there's just it seems to me an uphill climb to get this thing to the finish line. Maybe we'll be surprised and they'll get it. I mean, you do have Mitch McConnell saying he's going to vote for it. That at least in theory provides some cover to his members. But I don't know. I'm with you, Todd. It seems like an uphill climb.
Yeah, I think so.
We got a lot to get to this week, so let's keep cycling through. Next up, we want to take another quick look back at Iowa's June 7 primary election. But today, we're not talking about the results. Instead, we're looking at the number of absentee ballots that were filed in the primary election but missed the deadline and thus were not counted in the results. As a quick refresher, some background here, Iowa State House Republicans last year passed legislation that continued to shrink Iowa's early voting window. In addition to reducing the number of days that Iowans can cast an early vote, Republicans also placed a hard election day deadline on when returned absentee ballots can be accepted and counted. It used to be as long as you were postmarked or had the stamp that it was sent in before election day, it was, I think, up to 6 or 7 days after the election that they could be counted. That was eliminated as well. So that early voting window continued to shrink. Jared and Sarah, you've both been talking to your local election officials about this this past week. Jared, let's start with you. Do we know how many absentee ballots in Siouxland missed that deadline and thus were not counted?
So at least through this morning, not every single county that we focus on has gotten back to me. But of the ones that have, we're currently sitting at 146 denials across 10 counties. And that includes Woodbury, which had about 48 ballot requests that came in too late, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's worth, you know, noting, of course, that voter turnout in the county for the primary was only like 13.9%. So anything that all of a sudden creates any issue with casting a vote becomes more of an issue when your, you know, ceiling is as low as it is. And the thing that I kind of found the most interesting, and I'm wondering if Sarah's heard this too, is that more than one auditor I've talked with has said that things were generally okay under the new rules for the primary, but for the general election, they're worried. Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill told me over email that one of the things he's most concerned about with November is that he knows a lot of people are going to be expecting to get a request form and they're not going to get it. And that's going to end up being a real big test for a lot of counties and a lot of auditors' offices.
Sarah, over in the Quad Cities, interested to hear if you're hearing the same thing as Jared. And then also you mentioned that you have a kind of an interesting story about a batch of ballots that didn't get counted. What happened there?
Yeah. So in general, I think, yeah, the auditors that I talked to, I just talked to Scott in Clinton County, but they said that there weren't a lot of, you know, issues with the primary voting. Just so it's a primary election, but they're expecting maybe more people to, ahead of the general election, people are going to be, you know, it's going to be Democrats versus Republicans. So there's going to be a lot more maybe concern about whether or not my vote counts, whereas in a primary it's really intra-party, and unless there's an extreme example, there didn't seem to be a lot of concern. But then that leads me to, you know, this unusual example. So in Clinton County, and like Jared said, turnout in primary elections are generally pretty low, so if there is a batch of ballots that isn't counted for some reason, it can make a difference in a race. And so in Clinton County, there was a county supervisor's race, a Republican primary, that was decided by just 7 votes. There were 3 candidates. The top vote getter got like 100 or more than the next one. And then the 2 candidates were separated by just 7 votes. And then, so then 2 days after the primary election, the Clinton County auditor said 50 ballots arrived at the auditor's office by mail, and 35 of those were postmarked May 27th. So you'd think, you know, that would have been plenty of time to get to the auditor's office. But it turns out that apparently there may have been some kind of unintentional error at the post office that delayed a bag of mail getting through a mail processing facility, which may have caused the delay. And so, there were 23 Republican ballots that were postmarked ahead of June 7th, but came in the days afterward and had to be tossed out. So the loser in that race, Steve Cundiff, who's a sheriff deputy, was kind of a little sore about that loss, and, you know, thinks that, well, you know, had these, you know, we never know who these people might have voted for, but certainly 23 ballots and a 7 vote difference could have made a difference for him. And he's a little, he told me, he's like, well, I wonder if the post office, you know, decided this election or if the voters did. Not meaning that they did it intentionally, but just right. that, oh, did this error, you know, decide the election or did the voters? So,
yeah, that's such an, and look, it's fair to note here that when this most recent law change was being debated again in 2021, there were county auditors, local election officials of both political parties who warned state lawmakers, the Republican state lawmakers who were pushing this, about these exact kind of scenarios. They said that this is a really tight window you're creating, and if there's any snafu, any mix up at all, then ballots are going to end up not being counted because there's just not enough time for error. And I think Sarah's story is a perfect illustration of that. Like she said, those ballots were postmarked in plenty of time. At least what it is, I think, fairly reasonable to expect. And because of that, they didn't get counted. And look, we're talking about small numbers here in the grand scheme of things, 23 ballots in Sarah's case, 100 some that Jared mentioned over in his area. But I don't think it's unfair for even me as a reporter to offer the opinion that one is too high a number when you're talking about people's votes not being counted. It's really unfortunate, and you know, we want people to participate in this process, and these folks did. And because of issues that were not of their own making, their votes were not counted. And that should be concerning to anyone. So appreciate those stories, Jared and Sarah. Thank you. Moving on. Speaking of votes and voting early and other races coming up, we're going to see a lot of interest in that in this fall's general election, including in the race for governor, which is starting to pick up a little bit of post-primary steam. Democratic challenger Deidre DeGeer toured the state this past week to talk about education issues. Tom, you covered one of those DeGeer events in the Cedar Rapids area there. What did she have to say, and what kind of crowd did she draw? Is she getting people out to hear her pitches at this super early stage of the general election?
Yeah, so the Des Moines business owner and activist stopped at Raygun in Cedar Rapids, where she spoke to a small gathering of about 25 supporters and Linn County Democrats as part of a statewide campaign swing ahead of Iowa Democrats' state convention Saturday in Des Moines, and delivered her report card on Reynolds' performance during her first year. She gave Reynolds failing grades, of course, on a range of issues from the environment to education, healthcare, government transparency, housing, women's issues, jobs in the economy, you name it. So DeGeer talked about she sees hope and common ground among Iowa voters, including rural voters, which she thinks could potentially pave success for Democrats in November. She argued that Reynolds has prioritized extreme policies over Iowans, from pushing to provide taxpayer funding to pay for students to attend private schools, to a flat tax and abortion restrictions. Meanwhile, DeGeer argued that real issues like rural revitalization and access to quality, affordable health care and mental health care have been shortchanged. She said rural communities and rural Democrats are too often overlooked and that Iowa needs to do more to invest in those communities, and touted her Real Agenda, R-E-A-L. That's an acronym. What it stands for off the top of my head, I can't tell you, but it prioritizes rural revitalization, stating that she's committed to a thriving rural Iowa. It also prioritizes public education, mental health care, and access to quality, affordable health care. She asked her supporters, you know, are Democrats, are we willing to fight for that common ground, focusing on these more kitchen table issues of education, living wage jobs, protecting workers, again, access to quality, affordable health care, access to mental health care. She criticized Reynolds' push to use $55 million in state public school funding to provide 10,000 students with scholarships to pay private school expenses, stating that, quote, 100% of our students need the undivided attention of our governor in order to improve their opportunity within the education system, end quote. And then she also criticized the governor for stating that she believes the effect of climate change was overstated, despite the increasing frequency of severe storms and flooding across the state, including the August 2020 derecho that hit Cedar Rapids, quote, hard and heavy. So she's making the case that that she feels that Democrats have an opportunity to make some inroads, in rural Iowa and potentially, win back some disaffected Democratic voters and some independent voters in some of these communities by, you know, pointing out that Republicans or trying to make the argument that Republicans in the state are more focused on trying to wage a culture war, and that in the process, these issues that are of importance to all Iowans, not just Democrats, issues of, water quality and protecting Iowa's environment, trying to make a measurable dent in, curtailing the number of Iowa waterways that are impaired, putting meaningful funding behind water quality efforts, finally funding that Natural Resource Trust Fund that voters approved back in 2010 that has never been funded.
All right. And I had to add, Tom, I saw a photo from the event, and you mentioned the grades that Deidre Dejere had given Governor Reynolds. And I noticed the little attempt at humor and maybe snark in there, because they gave the Governor Reynolds 1A grade. And I thought, well, this has got to be interesting. And I zoomed in on it, and it was something to the effect of dedication to donors or special interests, something along those lines. Do I have that close to the mark?
Right. Yep. You're exactly right.
So yeah, we're off and running.
So it's a fair assessment then. There's an A mixed in there, so totally, totally fair. Totally.
That's right. All right. So lastly this week, we wanted to talk a little bit about the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling on abortion issued Friday morning. And so full disclosure here, and by way of background, we typically record the podcast on Friday mornings. I'm speaking to you at 9:35 a.m. on Friday, and just right around 9 o'clock, the ruling came down, and it's way more complicated than this, but based on what I've read and consumed so far, it does in essence overturn the 2018 Supreme Court ruling. So that one had a shelf life of 4 years, which is kind of wild to say for a Supreme Court ruling, even at the state level. But anyways, it essentially overturns that previous ruling that had said that abortion is a right protected by the state constitution. So that's no longer the case. And we still have a U.S. Supreme Court ruling as well that'll be coming down this summer that will also kind of set the landscape for what the future looks like on abortion access across the country and in Iowa and what state legislators here will be able to do. We'll get into this deeper in future podcasts when we've had a time to kind of digest this news and talk to people, the experts and advocates and stakeholders in the field on this. But we want to at least touch base on this. So Todd, let me just start with you and give me your initial thought on what this ruling means. Expand on it a little bit because I obviously gave a very, very super brief synopsis and what it means going forward in Iowa.
Well, it's you're right. They reversed the 2018 precedent that said that the Constitution guarantees a fundamental right for women to seek an abortion. In doing that, they sort of say that they don't establish a different standard. They basically, Justice Mansfield, who wrote the majority opinion, says that they'll basically go back to the U.S. Supreme Court standard in Casey, which is a law restricting abortion presents an undue burden. But that undue burden standard is probably going to collapse any day now when the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule striking down Roe v. Wade. And then, once that happens with this ruling in place and the Supreme Court ruling in place, I mean, I think that would pretty much open the door to any sort of abortion restrictions that the Iowa legislature and the governor decide to pursue. It's complicated. I mean, people ask me what the vote was. Well, there were a number of concur in part, dissent in part opinions, but what it boils down to is two Supreme Court justices, Chief Justice Christensen and outgoing Justice Brent Appel, both dissented in a way that both felt that the 24-hour waiting period at issue in this case is unconstitutional. But the majority didn't see it that way. And the ruling does mention that they don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, although we've seen a leaked draft, so we sort of know what might happen. But basically, striking down the fundamental right, and now they're going to sit back and wait to see what the Supreme Court does. And I think, there's a good chance that we're going to see pretty strict abortion limits in Iowa going forward if the governor wins re-election and, as expected, the Republican legislature returns.
So, Todd, you mentioned the governor. The governor's office did just release a statement about the Iowa Supreme Court ruling, calling it a, quote, significant victory in our fight to protect the unborn. And that, goes on to state that, every life is sacred and should be protected. And as long as she's governor, that's exactly what I'll do.
And when the draft leaked last month, I remember talking to a couple of legislators, one of them, Jackie Smith, which this feels applicable, and I'm assuming she would say something similar with the state court ruling, is that these kinds of rulings don't necessarily just, like, make abortions disappear altogether. It just makes them less easy to access and maybe more dangerous, which is a common line that you hear over and over again when these sorts of rulings come down. So,
yeah, and we're, neighboring states, Illinois, Minnesota, will continue to have legal abortion. And so for the people that have that option, that's where they'll go. But yeah, abortions will continue. And as you say, they'll be less safe. But it's going to have a huge impact if the legislature decides to move forward with a ban or something that is basically like a ban.
All right. As I said, obviously something that we'll have much more to report back on and on future podcasts, but we want to at least get some kind of quick reaction to that breaking news this morning. So appreciate that, from everybody here on the podcast. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of On Iowa Politics. Obviously, stay tuned in the future. If you enjoyed this morning's podcast, tell your friends, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast, and you can send fan mail to podcasts@thegazette.com. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll get all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to the On Iowa Politics newsletter at thegazette.com. And don't forget that the work of everyone you heard today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Sioux City Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Muscatine Journal, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Mick Fisto will play us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Tom, Sarah, Jared, Todd, and our producer, Stephen, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Get a daily update from the Gazette with our daily news podcast. Add it to your podcast player or your Alexa-friendly device to get a bite-sized local news update each day. Check it out at thegazette.com/podcasts.